Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, authors together of the best-selling and important Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. We're going to be talking about their new book, The Big Myth. This time, it's How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. And you can learn more at The Big Myth Book, all one word, thebigmythbook.com. On Free Forum, explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I woke up this morning and noticed some headlines, and I'm going to read you a few of them. One. Plastic is already in blood, breast milk, and placentas. Now it may be in our brains. The particles could be linked to cognitive impairment and neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. Two, North Carolina residents urge the UN to investigate toxic PFAS pollution. Chemical manufacturer Chemours accused of violating human rights by releasing forever chemicals into Cape Fear River Basin. Three, Biden is still not doing nearly enough about the climate crisis. The president is trying to appeal to climate conscious young voters and appease the fossil fuel industry. It won't work. Four, the godfather of AI leaves Google and warns of danger ahead. For half a century, Jeffrey Hinton nurtured the technology at the heart of chatbots like ChatGPT. Now he worries it will cause serious harm. And finally, dumb and dangerous, U.S. sees surge in efforts to weaken child labor regulations. 10 states have rolled back child labor laws recently, and now a federal bill would allow teens to work in one of the most dangerous industries. Now, those are actual headlines from The Guardian, The New York Times, The LA Times this morning. And, you know, there you go. What do they all have in common? Besides the dangers that they portend to our health, our environment, our democracy, our common sense, they all highlight the power of industry and the weakness of our government to protect us. Now, I've long laid the blame for that on a relentless, consistent, and scorched earth campaign of corporations, the wealthy, and the Republican Party to distort the political process, promote minority rule, and subvert the common good. And I usually start my story in the year 1970, when folks wear hats proclaiming their desire to make America great again. I assume they mean America from the end of World War II through the early 1970s. Though these were not the best of times for people of color, women, or the environment, to name a few exceptions, employment was solid, reliable, wealth was shared, the U.S. was leader of the world in many categories, and at the core of all of it was the greatest middle class the world had ever seen. And though that may be the time that MAGA folk look back on fondly, taxes were high, really high at times, unions were strong, and through the ongoing tussle between industry, labor, and government came success and growth. And rooted in 1960s idealism, we were out to share the prosperity even more. Richard Nixon signed into law both the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, for example. Some in economics and business were not happy with the direction things were taking, and two things happened in 1970 that I believe set us on a course that I and today's guest hope we can change. Milton Friedman, a New York Times op-ed, made his admonition that the sole purpose of corporate behavior was to enhance shareholder value. An attorney and soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote the Powell Memo advocating that business redefine its relationship to politics and government, and don't let anybody tell you that ideas don't matter. Both of these were just ideas, but they were both adopted with a vengeance, ultimately laying waste to shared prosperity. And with things like Citizens United, our politics have steadily become more and more instruments of that destructive strategy. The existential problem for the US, and as a result for the world, is that the market, unfettered, or more accurately, writing its own rules, cannot respond effectively to the most critical challenges we face. Crises that have either grown out of the distortion of our economy and our politics are unsolvable because of them. Inequality, climate change, an unhealthy relationship with the rest of nature, pandemics and public health, social and racial division and tribalism, crippled government, and endangered democracy. And we need to imagine a winning system that can respond to those crises at the level that's needed. Today's guests, Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, have done the research, the analysis, and written a book that expands the timeline and deepens my understanding of the right-wing corporate campaign I've just laid out. The book is The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. And the myth is that self-interest and business are the only route to a successful society. And as Ronald Reagan put it, government is the problem. Nestled within that myth is another, that free enterprise, as they call it, is a necessary precursor to a free society. And that interference by government is not only ineffective, but also a threat to democracy. And rather than begin their history after World War II, they go back to the early years of the 20th century, when this linkage between unrestrained capitalism and freedom was used to justify things like, are you ready? Remember the headlines I read at the top? Things like child labor laws. Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science at Harvard University, is author or co-author of 9 books, including Why Trust Science and Science on a Mission: How Military Funding Shaped What We Do and Don't Know About the Ocean. And over 150 scholarly and popular articles. In 2015, she wrote the introduction to the Melville House edition of the papal encyclical on climate change and inequality, Laudato Si. Her TED talk, Why We Should Trust Scientists, has been viewed more than 1 million times, and her opinion pieces have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, many other outlets, and she publishes a monthly column in Scientific American. Eric Conway, a historian of science and technology and rocketeer for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the California Institute of Technology, is the author or co-author of 7 books and dozens of articles and essays, including A History of Near-Earth Objects Research and Exploration and Engineering, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the Quest for Mars. He was elected a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2022. Now, together, they are co-authors of The Collapse of Western Civilization and Merchants of Doubt, which has been translated into 9 languages, sold over 100,000 copies, and was made into a 2014 documentary film by Sony Pictures Classics. Their latest, about which we'll be speaking today, is The Big Myth. Welcome Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Great. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, May 1st. Now, like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I'm going to ask you, East, to tell me a bit about your path, your personal path to the work you do. And feel free to go back. Sometimes people cite childhood experiences, a high school teacher, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing. And let me start. I'll start with you, Eric. Your path.
Okay, well, mine's a little complicated. I'm ex-Navy. I was both enlisted and an officer, and I did those things for about, 14 years, including ROTC time. I mean, after doing it, I decided I wanted to go to graduate school and learn something new, so I got a history of science degree, thinking I would go into the history of natural history, but by then, I'd spent so much time doing engineering-related work that history of technology was a stronger thing for me. And then I kind of fell into the work I do for NASA and JPL. And let's see, Naomi can tell you how Naomi, I guess Naomi and I got started working together.
Okay. Yeah.
So I was an exploration geologist. My undergraduate degree is in geology. I worked for a mining and exploration company in Australia in the early 80s, came back to grad school thinking I would become a geology professor, but discovered history and philosophy of science. And that was really eye-opening because I was always interested in science and I was always interested in nature. And I loved being outdoors. Almost every geologist I know became a geologist so we could be outside. But there were always these bigger questions I was interested in about science and its relationship to society and why scientists believe certain things and not others. And so I started down this path of history of science. And so fast forward about 10 years, I was working on the book on the history of oceanography that you just mentioned and came across a lot of evidence about the deep scientific roots of our understanding of climate change. So this was in the early 2000s, and I came to realize that there was a very deep scientific consensus on the reality of man-made climate change, but that's now not how it was being presented in the media, and it wasn't how it was being discussed by people like the president and vice president of the United States at that time. So I wrote an article, small article, one page, saying, hey, guys, there is a scientific consensus on climate change. People of goodwill could disagree about what to do about it, but we should be clear that it's really happening. And for that contribution to the peer-reviewed scientific literature, it was the first paper to say there was a scientific consensus on climate change. I started getting hate mail, threatening phone calls.
For a point of information, what year was that again?
2004.
Wow. Yep. So that's the first time someone said there was a consensus.
Well, it's not the first time someone said it. Scientists have been saying it for a long time. But what I did was the first analysis of the peer-reviewed literature to really like crunch the numbers and say, yes, here it is. So I wasn't the first person to say it, but I was the first person to document quantitatively using the peer-reviewed scientific literature.
Meta-analysis, boom, there you go.
Correct. And for that,
And the reaction was?
That I fell through the wormhole into the universe of climate change denial. And that was a very strange moment. I called it my Alice through the looking glass moment. I was suddenly living in a parallel universe. And I happened to meet Eric shortly after that at a conference in Germany, started talking a little bit about what was happening to me. And Eric said, and correct me if I'm misremembering this, but this is how I remember it, Naomi, some of the same people who are attacking you attack Sherry Rowland over the ozone hole. Now, for the audience who don't know, Sherry Rowland was one of the three scientists who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for accurately pointing out that a certain group of chemicals, the chlorinated fluorocarbons, were destroying stratospheric ozone, and by doing that, threatening the actual very existence of life on Earth. And Sherry Rowland had always been a hero to me because, to me, he's the quintessential example of a scientist, what I call the scientist as sentinel, a scientist who doesn't just stay in his lab and say, oh, sorry, I can't talk about the consequences of my work, but said, no, look, this is really important. And we can't just publish this in peer-reviewed literature. We have to tell people what's going on here because this is really, really dangerous. And he did that, and he became an advocate for the Montreal Protocol to protect the ozone layer. And for that, he was greatly rewarded by many people, but he was also viciously attacked by the forces of science denial. And it was Eric who really made that connection first. He sent me a bunch of material that he had in his file drawer. I started looking at it and I called and I said, I think we need to write about this.
It did take us a while to really figure out how to, though.
Yeah, well, it was our leap of faith. We scarcely knew each other. We'd met once at a conference, but I think we both recognized that there was an important story to be told here. I don't think we quite realized how big it was. And when we started pulling the threads, we kept finding more things. But that's the story of how we got to write Merchants of Doubt.
And so you guys have not written together. And if I'm not mistaken, you haven't written, shall we say, for the popular market yet either. And it's always an interesting break, I think, when people go from writing for their academic peers to shifting to popular. So how long did it take you to do Merchants of Doubt?
About 5 years, Eric?
Yeah, so I think we finally signed the contract late 05, early 06, and we delivered the manuscript in 2009. It's published in 2010. Okay. I think that's right.
And for people who kind of know the gist of the book, is the book has a life for many many thousands of people who probably haven't read it, but know the stake it put in the ground. You actually were writing about specific individuals, not just a strategy, right?
And right. So, I mean, part of what I think made the book maybe a bit, I want to say that book was easy to write because it wasn't, but a little easier than this latest book, is that we identified this group of men, four people, I think of them as a kind of gang of four, mm-hmm. who were really important voices in climate change denial and were among the ones who had also attacked the scientists over the ozone hole. And then we found this bigger story of them as sort of serial contrarians attacking science on a whole set of issues, all the way going back to tobacco. And so in some ways that made the book easier to write because we had these four very distinctive characters and we could follow their narrative thread. The new book is harder because it's a more complicated story. There are more different players. My husband just said to me, we should have had like one of those cards that a person could put next to them on their desk with a list of characters to keep track of, you know, who's on first.
And it's a longer time period of time too, since we located the origins of the myth back in the late 19th century, really. So
right, and this one you're tracking, you've got the myth and the strategy laid out, but then it's like all the events and personalities and so on that show up in the course of this, taking us to the present day. How long did it take you to write this one?
I think about the same, didn't we?
When it's
did we
about get to... ultimately about the same. It was supposed to be shorter, but it wasn't.
We know each other. We've done this before.
Yeah.
We got the Guggenheim in 2018, but we'd already been working on it for a couple of years before that.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask, any response to my introduction?
It's brilliant. I want to take you on the road with us.
Well, I guess I would say I've been saying for a while now that Naomi was prescient in starting the book with child labor, because I didn't see the effort to weaken the child labor laws coming. I just figured that was settled and no one would bother ever reopening them. And yeah, I was so wrong.
If I can tell a little anecdote on that. So two things I like to point out. Yeah, the child labor thing, you know, whenever Eric and I do this work, we often say, okay, well, one thing no one's going to question, right? They're not going to try to, and then, you know, then it happens, right? So one of my favorite lines of the book is the court decision over the issue of child labor. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, I believe it was 1918, if I'm remembering correctly, one of the few things that everyone in a civilized society agrees on is the evil of child labor. And here we are more than 100 years later, and we have, it shows how deep these people go, how powerful this mythology, this ideological framework is, that these people are prepared to sacrifice children on the altar of the free market.
Right, right. No, I mean, it stunned me because I actually have as my landing page the front page of The Guardian of London. Mm-hmm. And the top story today was child labor laws. I went, you can't make this up.
Yeah, and I'm going to give you one little anecdote too. I know it's a little...
Sure.
Rude to throw other people under the bus. But when this book first came out, I pitched the New York Times an op-ed based on this child labor thing and saying, look, here we are 100 years later, and the advocates of, you know, unregulated capitalism want to roll back child labor law. And the editor at the New York Times said to me, a very skeptical voice, well, oh, come on, how likely is it that any of these laws are going to pass? And I think this is such an important anecdote because one of the ways this works is that these people sometimes say things that are so outrageous that you think, oh, nobody could possibly take that seriously. Nobody could possibly want to bring back child labor. And so it's easy to dismiss it and think that, you know, it's just, it's not that big a deal. And I remember that happened when we were first talking about the Merchants of Doubt story. I remember quite a few people that I spoke to about what was going on kind of had the reaction that we were making a mountain out of a molehill. Okay, so there's these four guys that don't believe in climate change. And we were trying to point out it wasn't just the four guys, that this was the tip of the iceberg of a much larger story. So these four guys, in a sense, stood in for the whole universe of climate change denial. And I think that's happening again today, where the attempt to bring back child labor stands in for this entire universe of people who don't care about forever chemicals, who don't care about plastic getting into our brains and our blood, who don't care about the safety of workers, consumers, don't care about the climate crisis. And that's why these stories are so powerful.
And one of your questions in Merchants of Doubt, I'm sure, is what motivates people to, as you've just said, don't care about this, don't care about that, don't care about, and in that case, don't care about climate change. How did you figure out what their motivation was? And then tell us what it was. Eric, go ahead.
Well, we were trying to figure out in Merchants of Doubt why they were doing it. And, you know, there's the obvious argument to follow the money, but we really didn't have much evidence that they were profiting off of that effort. And so we had to come up with something else. And one thing that became clear in reading through the records they left was that they were champions of the free market, that they seem to have truly believed that any constraints on free market capitalism would lead to the slippery slope of socialism and maybe even totalitarian communism. And so it became our argument that they were market fundamentalists, as we use George Soros's term for it. That's where I got it from anyway. And that seemed to be their motivation.
But of course, there's a leap there too, because being a market fundamentalist might mean this or that in certain things, but why would they deny climate change? But as you point out, it's because they had to reach for an explanation for a market failure.
Exactly. And I think, you know, you said a minute ago, why didn't they care about climate change? But actually, they cared a lot.
They did.
They cared extremely deeply. They cared so much because if climate change is real, and if, as Nick Stern, the former chief economist of the World Bank, has said many times, that this is the greatest and most wide-ranging market failure ever, then it's telling us that capitalism as practice is failing, that we have this colossal market failure that threatens the future of our life on Earth. And if that's true, then you can't just say, oh, capitalism is fine, capitalism is great. And of course, the ozone hole was similar. And so that was the thing that suddenly we realized, and again, Eric really was the one who first recognized this, that united these different otherwise seemingly disparate stories. They were all market failures, places where a legal product like oil and gas or tobacco or chlorinated fluorocarbons was threatening the health, the well-being, the safety, and maybe even the existence of life on Earth. And so for a system that people think is good, you know, let's call it free market capitalism for lack of a better term, for a system, an economic system, to threaten the future of life on Earth means there has to be something at least a little bit wrong with that system. Right. But that was so that created this giant cognitive dissonance for these people. And so rather than acknowledge the reality, the severity, the significance of climate change and the ozone hole and the 6 million people dying every year from using tobacco, they said, oh, well, I don't believe the science. I'm not sure about that. I'm going to question the science. And so that's what leads them into science denial. And again, as I said before, from there into a whole world of science denial and the defense of free market capitalism. And so, you know, after Merchants of Doubt, it was pretty clear that that was what was going on, but that led to a new obvious question, which was, where did market fundamentalism come from?
Right. And why does it work? And that, I think, is one of the key things. As I said, I've been, you know, talking about this. And as I say, usually starting the story at World War II at the earliest, 1970, you know, at another point. But what you did was, as I say, just expand my timeline, that there was a context, there was a rich soil kind of that was easy to make that market fundamentalism supplied the soil that made these denials acceptable and believable. And one thing I have to say, just as a side comment, is that scientists who are actually practicing science pretty much can't be fundamentalists, because science is a question more than it's an answer. And so that they would be scientists in their lab or whatever, but fundamentalists in their life, you know, and it turns out the fundamentalism trumps the curiosity.
Well, the fundamentalist, fundamentalism in their economics, yeah. And it gradually infects their understanding of science, I think, is the way I saw it.
Right.
Yeah, the way I've talked about it is it's an ideology that becomes a pathology. It starts as a political or ideological framework, which you could argue you know, you could agree or you could disagree, but then it becomes kind of pathological because it leads people to reject clear scientific evidence. And we saw that during the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, I think that's where I came up with this phrase when we did a piece for Time magazine about how our work connected to the pandemic. So here you have a virus that is literally a matter of life and death. People are dying in front of your eyes, and yet you refuse to accept the scientific evidence that masking works. You refuse to accept the scientific evidence that vaccines work because you see it as an infringement on personal freedom, because you see it as, quote, government encroachment. And so you refuse to accept the evidence even when people around you are dying. Mm-hmm. That's pathological, right?
Yeah. And the key point in that one is distinct from ozone hole or climate change is the immediacy. It's not like, oh, there's a future threat to civilization. It's like people are dying in down the block or in your house. So as I said, if you haven't yet, and I think we sort of dance around it, but give me a definition of market fundamentalism.
Well, so the way I like to think about it is that there's three pieces to this myth, right? The first piece is simply the idea of the free market, talking about the market as something that exists unto itself outside of society and culture. That's just wrong, right? Markets are tools, they're human institutions. They've existed as long as there has been human civilization, so they're not necessarily tied to capitalism. And as long as people have had markets, they've also had rules about how those markets operate. So the question really shouldn't be, do we believe in the free market? The question is, what rules and regulations should we have for the operations of markets so that they work effectively to serve our needs rather than, you know, poisoning us with toxic chemicals? The second part of it has to do with the role of government. So the myth sets up the market as this thing unto itself, which has autonomy and wisdom, right? That we should trust, believe in the invisible hand, so it has a sort of godlike quality, and that government action in the marketplace distorts the market, that the government gets in the way. And so you'll see people in Wall Street, you know, in the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, the government needs to just get out of the way and let the market do its magic. So the anti-government piece is as important to this story as the idealization or deification of the marketplace. And then the third piece is the piece you alluded to, and this is the piece I think that most people have not understood, and I think is probably the most original contribution of our work. I mean, lots of people know that, you know, PFAS chemicals are bad, right? But this idea that was promoted that that markets aren't just good because they deliver goods and services efficiently, but that they actually protect our political freedom. And it's this, it's a really noxious and really, what's the word I want here? I mean, it's just a despicable distortion, because it essentially makes the market the protector of political freedom rather than the government. And so it turns things on its head. Rather than the government being a tool of democracy, rather than the government being the expression of the will of the people, the government now becomes this toxic force that potentially is taking away our freedom.
Yeah. So on the one hand, they deny that to the market fundamentalists, neither the market nor the government is a tool, right?
They're both sort of big abstract concepts. So the market is good, the government is bad. We deify the marketplace, we demonize government, and then use that ideology to dissuade people from trying to use government as a tool to protect themselves. And this is really where it becomes so really dastardly is the word that's in my head right now, right? So normally we would, all those things you read about, all those headlines that we started, we would look to the government to regulate PFAS. We'd look to the government to protect children against abusive practices. We would look to government to solve pretty much all of the problems that you just talked about. But if we've been persuaded that government is the problem, that government is not the solution to our problems, government is the problem, then we don't turn to government. And what are we left with? We're left with, well, just trust the marketplace. Yeah. And it's that way of thinking that I think has contributed in a really substantial way to this sort of cascading
something
crises.
I picked up from your writing, and that I think might be even more subtle, is that they don't want to consider the market a tool because that diminishes it. I think one of the main points when we get to the end of the hour as to what's the meaning of this and what's the use of your work is to say what we want to do is balance You finally admit that the market is a tool and that it should be a tool for well-being. And that right. it is not, I mean, whatever they, I mean, I'm trying even to think. They don't think it's a tool. They think it's what? Reality? I mean, what is
it? Well, so, yes. And we spend a lot of time talking about the idea of markets as tools, markets as our constructs, and that we should design them to, you know, we being small d Democrats to benefit the majority as opposed to the way they are now. But if you think about the way the big myth we've described operates, it disempowers most of the public, right? And that means that the business people are the ones who shape the markets, they and their lobbyists in Congress, because they know their tools and they know that markets are constructs. And by convincing the rest of us to leave them alone, they get to design markets in ways that benefit themselves, yeah. right? But don't think that business people or economists for a second believe that markets are divine or independent or anything. They know better than that.
Got it. By the way, let me tell you are listening to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway. And they are authors together of the best-selling and important Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And we're talking about their new book, which sort of is the context in which Merchants of Doubt takes place. And the new book is The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. And you can learn more about the authors at their respective university faculty websites, Oreskes at Harvard and Conway at Caltech. And you can learn more about the book at thebigmythbook.com. Okay, so we've got this. Let's do a little bit of the history, because as I said, I agree with you, by the way, that I think the key new insight of your book is the connection, the point of connecting free enterprise to democracy, and that without free enterprise, you can't have democracy. And they made what was, as you said, there's representative democracy, there's the vote, there's all those things. And they added this as if this was part of the brew. But the other one is that it didn't start when a lot of us think it started. It started much earlier. And again, it's that dark poetry of child labor laws. Tell us a bit about that early history, because that's, I think, going to be news to a lot of people.
Well, I think this also helps maybe to answer your last question about capitalism. One of the points that Eric and I are trying to make in this book is that capitalism isn't one thing. Capitalism is an economic system that has evolved over time. The capitalism that we have today, which is this sort of very highly deregulated, financialized global capitalism, is really, really different than what Adam Smith was advocating at the end of the 18th century. And it's different from the sort of managerial capitalism that developed in the 19th century. So part of our argument is that talking about capitalism with a capital C is really misleading, in the same way that talking about the free market, you know, with a the in front of it is misleading. So the real question, or one, I should say one of the questions, is how our understanding of capitalism has evolved. And so we begin the book in the early 20th century, when there was widespread recognition of the really profound social costs of capitalism as it was being practiced in the United States at that time. And we focus on two major debates that took place in the early 20th century. One was child labor, and the other was workmen's compensation. So most Americans don't know that in the early 20th century, it was extremely common for children as young as 2 years old to work in textile mills, to work in factories, to work in mines. And various reformers tried to argue against that and to say, no, this isn't right. These children have no opportunity to advance in society, no opportunity to become educated, no opportunity to live a good life and become productive citizens. The death rates among children who began working at these very young ages was astronomical. And so many, many people thought, well, yeah, that's right, children really shouldn't be working in factories. So there was widespread popular support for the idea of restricting, putting limits, having laws to protect children from working in factories and mines and mills. But the business community began to fight back, to say, no, this is an inappropriate infringement on the rights of business, the freedom of a factory owner to decide for himself how to run his own business, and also a patriarchal element, the freedom of a father to decide what is right for his sons, usually cast in those terms, although girls also worked. Yeah. And so in this debate, we see the beginnings of this argument about freedom, using freedom as a tool to push back against government regulation of the marketplace, because everyone loves freedom. So the idea is you take a noxious practice like child labor, but you defend it by invoking some higher ideal, which is freedom. And so in the book, we show how then that gets carried through a whole set of debates, including debates over workplace injury. This is another thing that's been mostly forgotten, except by a few American historians. Massive rates of workplace injury and death in the early 20th century. One of my favorite statistics in the book was this calculation I did that a boy, a 15-year-old boy in 1914, would have been safer going to fight in World War I than going to work on the railroads or in an anthracite mine. It was that dangerous. But again, when people said, well, look, this is really bad, we should do something. And in fact, we have models for what we could do in Europe, in Germany, and in the United Kingdom. There was workmen's compensation, and that created an incentive for factory owners to clean up the workplace, make it safer. But the business community fought back, saying, no, that's an infringement on our freedom. And if you allow the government to tell us how to run our factories, it's only a matter of time before we lose democracy. And that's how we then see emerging this argument they make that they call the tripod of freedom. And it involves a major rewriting of American history. I mean, it's really a fabrication. It's a lie, to put it bluntly. But they make this claim that the American society was founded on three pillars. One of them, representative democracy, so far so good. The second, the rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights, also good. But the third one, equally important, they claim, is free enterprise. And so the argument is that if you allow the government to compromise free enterprise, whether it's child labor laws, minimum wage, Social Security, then the whole structure risks collapsing. It's a tripod. So if one leg is compromised, the whole thing falls. And they use this argument then during the 1930s and into the early 40s to fight back against the reforms of the New Deal.
And one thing you point out is that they lose a lot. That as I said in the intro, and as is implicit in your book, is that we have crises that this is not going to take and handle. The Depression was one of those. But I wanted to point out and ask you to comment on. It seems to me that nowadays in America, you'll hear a fourth part of that tripod. And the fourth one will be Christian nationalism. And that now it's not just freedom, it's God-given rights. I don't know if you saw someone, I saw an article last week in which he pointed out how many people use the phrase God-given rights to apply to their gun ownership, which if you think of how absurd, I mean, there's very few things you could think of that would be more absurd than that. But do you agree that that's now in the current incarnation of this? It seems to me they've added that to it.
Well, one of the things we've done in The Big Myth is we explored early efforts to embed free market economics into Christianity, into American Christianity, to ensure that Americans heard about, you know, God in the markets from their churches, from their church leaders, their ministers, pastors, priests, what have you. And we didn't take it because we didn't have documentary evidence into the present. So we don't discuss the current push for Christian nationalism. But we did it to set the idea of the free market in that religious context, because we follow a guy named James Fifield in the late 30s through the early 50s. And one of the things Fifield was trying to do was deify rights, to make our Bill of Rights freedoms into gifts of the divine, and extend those to property rights, right? In the Constitution, in the Fifth Amendment, right, property rights can be amended by Congress. But according to James Fifield, they were gifts from God. And the whole idea there, once you deify something, sacralize it, it no longer can be modified by Congress or by any human power, right? That's where he was going with all this material. And we talk about that in the book because we thought that was essential to understanding how we get to market fundamentalism being such a seemingly sacrosanct construction.
Right. Yeah, and if I could jump in here, I think that's extremely important. As Eric said, we don't talk about contemporary Christian nationalism in the book, but we do show in many different ways the way in which these people try to turn economic rights into God-given rights. And so one of my favorite examples involves the work of Friedrich von Hayek, the neoliberal Austrian economist. So in the book, we tell the story of how a group of businessmen linked to the National Association of Manufacturers, and particularly the DuPont Corporation, actually bring Friedrich von Hayek to America. They work behind closed doors to get him hired at the University of Chicago and then to promote his ideas in popular culture. And they do this in part by making dumbed down versions of his book. So his 1944 book, The Road to Serfdom, is massively quoted by right-wing commentators, Republican politicians all across the United States, including today, people like Ted Cruz, Paul Ryan, et cetera. If you actually read the book, it's a very interesting book. I don't entirely agree with it, but it's nuanced, it's subtle. And Hayek acknowledges that there have to be exceptions to market fundamentalism. For example, he supports the idea of social security to protect people from extreme hardship. But what his business acolytes do is they strip out all the caveats, they strip out all the nuance, and they produce a Reader's Digest condensed version, which is just a kind of manifesto for the free market. And when it's published in Reader's Digest, it's accompanied by an illustration, which looks like the Ten Commandments. It's a set of tablets. And the foundation is the belief in God. And then these tablets begin with basic rights such as freedom of speech. But then they go on to the right to property, right? And the right to be free of government regulation. So they're now taking these economic principles and reinstantiating them as a kind of Ten Commandments. And as Eric points out, and I feel that often people seem to forget this, you know, people often view property rights as sacrosanct, as something that the government cannot under any condition abridge. The Chicago School of Economics is heavily vested in the protection of property rights as a basic principle of almost all their work. But actually, if you think about what the Constitution says, it says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, right? In other words, actually, you can deprive people of these things if you have a law that justifies it for whatever reason. So property rights are not absolute. They're not given by God. In fact, as many, you know, indigenous people have pointed out, there's some really big problems with the way we understand property rights in this country. But the idea is to make it seem as if these are commandments that have come from God and therefore really can't be questioned.
Strong stuff, strong stuff. One thing I want to say, and I don't think I want to take time for you to comment on this, so I'm just going to throw this in, is that one of the things that strikes me is that the moneyed interests who are using the evangelicals and abortion and other things to promote their financial and corporate goals end up not only promoting corporate goals that are damaging to our health and perhaps to our planet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but they also fan the flames of the most base instincts. It's like a bargain that you lose on both sides. In order to do what they want as corporations, they promote bigotry and white nationalism and all of these things. And it's like, it's the worst of both worlds. It's like the devil made a deal with the devil.
Well, it's kind of,
yeah.
Yeah, it's as if they don't believe that pact will ever harm them. Mm-hmm. And maybe it won't. So far, it hasn't really. But they also understand that getting to that sort of primitive brain bit of humanity is one of the things that gives them such power.
That's right. That's right. Although, and they're willing.
Yeah,
in other words, again, the cost is not a cost to them.
No, but just to jump in, I mean, in fairness, the book is not an indictment of all American business. I mean, we're tracking a very definite group of people, influential trade organizations like the National Association of Manufacturers, the National Electric Light Association, corporations like General Electric, who did some really terrible things that we document very, very clearly. The evidence of their activities is overwhelming. Where I fault the rest of American business, though, is standing by and not standing up to it, right? That they benefit. They're willing to benefit from, say, the weakening of child labor laws or weakening of environmental protections, but not stand up and say, no, we actually don't think child labor is a good idea. And that, so that's where I fault sort of the larger world of American business.
Yeah, very fair. Is there? And
your book is a history. So I want to give you a little time now. I mean, it's so fun to talk about the ideas, but some of that stuff that happened in that most people aren't aware of with the National Association of Manufacturers and the Electric Light Group and Ronald Reagan. So if one of you wants to take, you know, pre-Reagan and wants to take Reagan, fine, but run with that, please.
Well, Naomi wrote the Reagan and GE stuff, so she should do it.
Okay. Well, so one of the stories we tell in the book has to do with how Ronald Reagan became the Ronald Reagan that we know. So many people know that Reagan was an actor before he went into politics. But what they don't know is how that transition was affected. In the 1940s and early 50s, Reagan was still a Democrat. He was the president of a union, the Screen Actors Guild. And by the late 50s, he's this extremely anti-government Republican, an anti-union Republican. So how did that happen? So in the book, we show that this transition took place when he worked for the General Electric Corporation. And he was the host of a television program, a very popular, very well done program called General Electric Theater. But that wasn't his whole job. Half of the job was hosting General Electric Theater, which each week showed didactic story of people solving their problems through their own initiative, standing on their own two feet, not relying on government. But also he went on the lecture circuit on behalf of GE, where he promoted a set of views that were held by GE executives, particularly an executive by the name of Lemuel Boulware. Boulware was extremely anti-union, had been responsible for practices that actually earned GE, citations from the National Labor Relations Board. They were so bad, they got a name, Boulwareism. And also extremely anti-government. And so he developed this propaganda program within GE to propagandize GE employees not to join unions, to believe in the power of the marketplace, to believe in that government was the problem, not the solution. And Reagan then went on the lecture circuit in GE communities, places where there were GE factories, speaking to school groups, teachers, Rotary clubs. And then his speeches would be then reported on in GE newsletters and magazines that then went out to the GE communities, this massive propaganda campaign with what was essentially became Reagan's pro-market, anti-government philosophy. And so we really show in the book how the Ronald Reagan, who then became so influential, really comes out of General Electric with a set of views that are essentially just about identical to the views of GE executives. And he also comes out with one other thing, which is powerful and wealthy backers who then fund his campaign to run for governor of California.
That's right. And I think people know, as you mentioned, that people know, oh, he made some silly B movies and, you know, the with the chimpanzee or and some may even know he did baseball announcing, you know, that sort of thing. But this moment now, I'm old enough to have watched GE Theater. I didn't realize, I think you say it was the third most popular show in the country at the time, which is wild. But I certainly, as a child, had no idea that all of the stories were selling me a philosophy. And you point out the same thing happened with Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
Little House on the Prairie.
So we wound up incorporating Little House on the Prairie in the book because of its ghostwriter, Rose Wilder Lane. It's a couple of other, I think they're actually language scholars, Christine Woodside and Carolyn Frazier, had done a lot of work to discover that Rose Wilder Lane was the ghostwriter for Mother Laura Ingalls Wilder for these Little House on the Prairie books that are published in the 1930s and into the 1940s. Rose crafted those narratives into libertarian parables in pursuit of her own vision of politics. And she claims to be one of these folks who kind of started as socialist leanings and then converted into hard libertarian capitalists. And she became not just influential in the literary world for this. She formed an alliance with J. Howard Pugh, the president of Sun Oil, who and some others who got her a job managing book reviews for an economic journal, and for whom she became a part of an effort to suppress undesirable textbooks. And we tell the story of one by an economist by the name of Laurie Tarshish, whose crime was publishing a textbook on Keynesian economics right after World War II in 1946. And to J. Howard Pugh and his allies, this thing was tantamount to communism. And so they went on a tech campaign to get it banned by universities by writing trustees and you know, the deans of economics programs and so forth to try to get it suppressed. So the Little House in the Prairie gal wound up being much more influential than we think. One of the places we couldn't determine, though, is, you know, how influential was it? Naomi read the Little House in the Prairie books as a kid, living in the least prairie-like place in the United States, New York City. And, you know, it didn't turn her into a libertarian, but some people, maybe it did. It's one of the larger purpose in constructing the book was to try to look at the way these messages are put into different aspects of American culture. So a Christian capitalism culture was about embedding free market messages in churches. Laura Ingalls Wilder's and Rose Wilder Lanes' work was about embedding them in children's books, et cetera. So Americans hear this all the time from every media outlet.
Right. Oh, and one thing I wanted to say, when you said that they did Hayek's book as a Reader's Digest condensed, people usually mean that as a metaphor.
No, literally.
It was literal.
Right.
Yeah.
This is fact.
It was dumbed down and shortened and made palatable in Reader's Digest.
Right. In fact, most of the things we talk about the book are not metaphorical. These are things that were actually done as matters of facts. And I think, you know, just to touch on what Eric said about, I grew up reading these books along with millions and millions of other people, young people around the world, not just the United States. These books are still in print today. My own children read them. I found copies of them in my attic when we were writing this book. So yeah, it's true. It didn't turn me into a libertarian, but I think that, like nearly all Americans, it did help to instantiate in me the idea that you should stand on your own two feet, you know, that you should be responsible for your own life and not rely on other people. And if you think hard about that, it's really an insidious argument, because no one lives alone. No one stands on their own two feet. We all depend on our families, our friends, our communities, our churches, our synagogues, our mosques, our schools, our teachers. I mean, the list of people that we need to thrive, our doctors, our dentists, you know, the list goes on and on and on. So it's a really noxious message to try to persuade people that somehow we exist as individuals. And in the case of the Little House on the Prairie books, it was also a lie. Because, of course, those settlers would not have been there without the effects of the Homestead Act. And so the books also serve to recapitulate the effacement of Native Americans. So, yes, those books did not make me into a libertarian. But I would say it wasn't until I was an adult, well into my 30s, 40s, that I really came to understand what had been done to Native American people in this country.
Right. Right.
Yep,
okay. Fair. We're very close to the end. Say we've got like 3 or 4 minutes. We've done diagnosis, we've done history, and I know you're historians, so it's not fair to ask you about the future or the solution, but I'm going to. So let me ask you both, and I want to, if you want to, Naomi, I think, well, I guess it's both of you. If either one of you wants to mention that analogy with biological regulation, I think that is very strong.
Okay, well, I can do that because that was That was came from me. So when we were finishing the book, we were struggling with exactly this question, because one of the things we've learned as historians, if you write a complex, subtle, sophisticated history, and then at the end say, here's the solution, people just argue with you about the solution and ignore all the hard work you did to get to that point. So as in Merchants of Doubt, we really wanted to focus on the historical story to invite a larger conversation about the solutions, which I think we desperately need. And I appreciate that in a way that's what you're trying to do, Terrence. But I did come up with one idea, which was that I really wanted to make the case that because we've been so bombarded by this kind of anti-government thinking, many of us, including progressives, I think have accepted the idea of regulation as bad. We think of regulation as a necessary evil, and we think of it as something, and I think we definitely in the book show that this was the case for Bill Clinton, I think it was the case for Obama, and I think to some extent it's even the case for Joe Biden. Viewing regulation as something that, you know, we kind of have to suck it up and swallow it. I don't really like it, but we kind of need it, right? I think that's completely wrong. I think that we should embrace the notion of regulation as a good thing, because regulation is what makes systems work. And so the example we give is biological regulation. In biology, the concept of regulation is an absolutely mainstream concept because it's understood that all organisms have to regulate their internal systems. A warm-blooded animal can't exist unless it can maintain its temperature. Even a cold-blooded animal can't exist unless it can maintain its internal biochemistry. And the same is true of plants, right? I mean, how does a leaf hold itself together? So biological regulation is what makes life possible. And so I think a better system of economic regulation, of market regulation, is what's going to make it possible for us to continue to live life productively, live a good life with stuff we like. I mean, you know, I like to always say, I'm not against stuff. I really like my water bottle, right? But in a way that doesn't poison the planet that we depend on to survive.
Right. And you made the point earlier, Naomi, that you're not condemning all business, all businesses, all business people. It's what you're asking for is a rebalancing. And obviously nature, and the other metaphor or analogy that works very well is sports. In other words, no one complains that there should be no rules in the NBA playoffs. This would be absurd. Yep. There is no way to do our best and all that competition that these folks love unless there are rules. Eric, your thoughts about where we go from here to escape this, you know, this trap.
Right. Well, as Naomi says, there's and as you say, there's the biological regulation argument. There's also the argument that, you know, even sports have rules, and if anything, sports have more rules and they're better understood than practically anything else. So you get people, bars full of people arguing intricate details of the rules of football, basketball, baseball, whatever have you.
Yep.
What I would say is that I've seen our work as inoculation partly. The more people who understand what's going on, the better, as in terms of market rules being set by business people and not really to benefit the majority, and the history of all that is important. But what also has to change is the people in the folks in the corporate suites have to sort of re-engage with the ideas of managerial capitalism circa 1960, when a lot of business leaders saw their jobs as not just making the best money possible for the investors, but also reinvesting in their communities, being part of their communities and supporting them. And in order to get back to that society that was still just as wealthy, but the wealth was better shared.
Yeah. As I said at the top, that was that moment was a moment of growing shared prosperity, which according to some folks had to be tamped down and redirected.
We're still capitalist.
We could go on partially even just if we just spent time on more of the stories that you guys have, which we didn't have that much time to do. But let me tell people, the book is The Big Myth: How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. You can learn more about the authors at their respective university faculty websites, Oreskes at Harvard and Conway at Caltech. And you can learn more about the book at The Big Myth Book, all one word, thebigmythbook.com. Thank you, Naomi Oreskes. and Eric Conway. Keep up your good work. For this conversation, many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my email announcement weekly telling you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about, and usually links to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com, or you can sign up at my website. You can also sign up for the podcast at most of the websites where it runs, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, you name it. And in the archives, you will find Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams and Federico Garcia in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, share this podcast widely. And again, thanks to both of you, and keep up your good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.